You are now listening to Macrodose.
Hello and welcome to Macrodose, a podcast hosted by me, James Meadway, that brings you your weekly fix of everything economics in a quick 15-minute roundup. Each Wednesday morning, we bring you the key stories making the news and the analysis you need to make sense of them. On today's episode, we'll take a look at, first, Thames Water is once again on the edge of bankruptcy. Why is it permanently failing, and how do we fix our water system? Second, we turn to the incredible resource costs of artificial intelligence and how they are feeding into old, colonial forms of exploitation. And finally, a brief note on climate inflation and how new research shows prices are only likely to increase into the future. Time for our first story this week, the disaster that is Thames Water, a company that supplies water to about one quarter of households in England and yet somehow manages to find itself continually teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. Last week, Thames Water was plunged into a fresh financial crisis after shareholders refused to provide £500 million worth of funding to prop up the ailing utility. This somewhat motley collection of investors, including pension funds, the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, and the state-owned China Investment Corp, have refused to bolster Thames Water's parent company, Kemble Investments, unless regulators allow them to, amongst other things, increase domestic water bills by a whopping 40%. Kemble took on Thames Water's colossal debts when it bought the company from Australia-based financial services group Macquarie back in 2017. Macquarie had been using the complex financial structures of the privatised English water system to load up Thames Water with more than £18 billion worth of debt, while simultaneously also driving up profits to record levels. This has been the pattern across the industry since English Water was privatised in 1989, paying out massive dividends to shareholders whilst taking on more borrowing and failing to invest adequately in overhauling our antiquated water infrastructure. In total, the water companies have paid out £72 billion in dividends since privatisation and borrowed more than £60 billion. Meanwhile, England's rivers were flooded with raw sewage for 3.6 million hours last year, the worst year on record. This is a direct result of insufficient investment in that water infrastructure. So Thames Water isn't so much a water supply company as a financial extraction machine with a water company incidentally attached. And from the shareholders' point of view, the business model has been working just fine. That is, until recently, when interest rates began rising and that mountain of debt became kind of unpayable. Hence, we ended up here with the threats of bankruptcy and massive rises in domestic water bills. Now, I can't stress this enough. There is actually a simple solution to all of this. Force Thames Water into bankruptcy and renationalise it, writing off its debt and forcing shareholders to take the losses. Obviously, they'll complain bitterly about this and quite likely try various legal ruses like taking the government to court to duck their responsibilities, but ultimately, this is a simple approach. What we need is a government that is much more robust and willing to stand up what is little more than larceny by shareholder groups. And it's here that I think the concept of environmental insolvency could prove useful. Environmental insolvency is the idea that once you take into account the future costs of climate change, these companies, water companies in this case, are no longer going to be sustainable in any meaningful sense. The House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee has estimated that the liabilities of the water companies, given climate pressures, amount to around £200 billion in England alone. If central banks and financial companies are now starting to take account of environmental costs when looking at their balance sheets, and so factoring in rising future risks, why shouldn't other big corporations do so too? The water companies should be wound up and their assets transferred to the public sector. Any delays on nationalisation for Thames Water at this point are pretty much delaying the inevitable. England is exceptional across the globe in having a fully privatised water system, with public ownership expert Professor David Hall estimating that around 90% of the world's water systems are otherwise in public hands. Most countries, including here Scotland, had more sense than to try and push neoliberalism as far as water ownership. That much is probably pretty familiar to listeners. The debate has raged onwards about the merits of water privatisation for some time, And by this point, it's overwhelmingly unpopular with the general public, who, for some reason, object to sky-high bills and rivers full of feces. And that's a bigger context here, and one that isn't so much discussed in the media, and that's the growing pressure on water resources in the UK and across the globe. The Environment Agency last week reported on growing water shortfalls in the UK, rising to a deficit of 5 billion litres a day by 2050, or more than a third of total available supply at present. This comes in spite of forecasts around worsening floods as climate change digs in. Essentially, we will have too much water when and where we don't need it, and not enough in controlled quantities when and where we do. Coupled with the lack of investment in basic infrastructure, not a single new reservoir has been opened in England in 30 years, for instance, and the problems will start to become acute. Nationalising water companies is only a start. There is likely to be a need to prioritise uses of water as shortages worsen, so favouring domestic consumption over businesses and agriculture, for example, and then to deal with the knock-on economic impacts of doing so. This is what chronic shortages are likely to provoke. This problem is obviously global, not just national. The Pacific Institute, based in California, has been compiling a regular record of water-fueled conflicts around the world, which have seen a marked uptick in the last few years. We've seen attacks on dams and pipelines in Ukraine, clashes between Iran and Afghanistan over access to the Helmand River, and attacks by the IDF on pumps supplying Palestinian villages. In Mexico, in September 2020, police fired on protesters, angry at the diversion of water from Chihuahua into the United States, and they killed two people. And we've covered the Megabassines protests in France on Macrodose before, with protesters organising against big agribusiness to dispute their privileged access to fresh water. I'm personally reasonably confident that we'll see the absurd privatised water system in the UK brought back into some form of public ownership, although the devil here will be in the detail. So who is made to bear the costs of failure, the taxpayers or the shareholders? But either way, this is just the first step. Rationally managing an increasingly scarce but essential resource like water obviously isn't going to be possible on the basis of profit. But nor does public ownership end the hard questions about who gets what water when, where, and for what purpose. Questions for a future show, perhaps. For now, let's put a stop to this absurd racket that is privatised water. It's well past time we brought our essential utilities back under public control. Our second story this week is back to an old favourite, so-called artificial intelligence, AI, and its monstrous consumption of increasingly scarce resources. As we've covered before in Macrodose, the electricity demands of AI are extraordinarily large and rapidly increasing, as both the complexity and the amount of data being processed also increases. In 2020, it took about 27 kilowatt hours to train what was then the leading large language model, but by 2022 it took 1 million kilowatt hours of electricity. That's a 37,000 times increase in power consumption in just 2 years. And once trained on these vast quantities of data that AI gobbles up, actual use of the model generates its own electricity demands. A new paper suggests that generating one AI image uses about as much power as charging a smartphone. Now, that isn't too much by itself, but of course, once that image generation power is replicated millions of times, the energy demands become significant. Data centres globally currently use about the same amount of electricity as the whole of South Africa, for comparison. That big new demand for electricity from AI is coming at the same time as the demand for electricity from decarbonisation also surges. Decarbonisation, as it is being carried out at present, primarily means switching one set of technologies for another. Out with fossil fuels like petrol engine cars, and in with things like shiny new electric vehicles. But since the technological switch is primarily a switch into electrifying everything, demand for electricity is set to soar. And that, in turn, places aging electricity grids in the developed world, built many decades ago for a time when electricity demand was massively lower, under enormous strain. Brownouts and blackouts are on the rise in places like the US, as existing electricity grids strain to meet demand and to cope with worsening weather conditions. The larger tech companies are looking to solve this problem directly. Amazon Web Services recently bought a 100% nuclear-powered data center in Pennsylvania for $650 million, for example. Surging demand is leading to continued use of coal power in the US, with Kansas, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and South Carolina all delaying planned coal plant closures. But it's natural gas, production of which has ballooned in the US over the last decade or so, that the industry itself expects to deliver the rapid expansion in electricity supply for its new data centers. This is the exact opposite of decarbonization. It would represent a significant recarbonization of US electricity production. So, for the first time ever, last summer, the majority of US electricity actually came from natural gas. There's another major resource issue that's starting to bite here too. Water is used on a vast scale for the manufacture of silicon chips that power the AI servers, and then also in the cooling of those servers once they're up and running. One new estimate suggests that the total artificial intelligence water consumption across the globe will be about the same as half the United Kingdom's by 2027. The great difficulty here is that with climate change and intensive agriculture already shrinking usable water resources across the world, conflicts over the use of that water become more likely. These conflicts start to take on a decidedly colonial tinge as the major tech companies, primarily from the US, start to look further afield for cheap energy and water sources. The US's traditional backyard, Latin America, is an appealing prospect, where both electricity and water are typically significantly cheaper, as a recent report on Mongabay argues. The volume of data processed in Latin America has doubled since 2020, and Mexico, with its location leaving it proximate to both main markets for data on the two continents, data center growth has surged, growing by 11% a year over the last few years, with further expansion expected. There's also a large local workforce, often with higher education, available for much less than would have to be paid in the US or elsewhere across the developed world. But the demands for resources from the US corporations are diverting them away from local populations. Querétaro in northern Mexico has 10 data centers already, with an astonishing 18 further under construction. But it's also one of the regions of Mexico most susceptible to drought. The result is that local farmers are finding their already limited water resources for crops diverted into keeping the servers humming. Protests, according to Mongabay, are already starting up. "It's not drought, it's plunder," was the slogan paraded outside Querétaro's council buildings by local farmers. It's also worth bearing in mind what all these data centers are doing. The tech companies like to sell machine learning as the tool that will find fantastic new medical advances. And of course, there are real possibilities here, but the majority of what those servers are processing is consumer data, steered towards selling advertising space more efficiently. There's a point where we have to start to think about what the technological capacities we have are actually being used for. That this isn't just about responding to consumer demand, or, in reality, big companies actively trying to create new demands. On some level, there has to be a reassertion of social control over the direction and purpose of the technologies in use. There has to be some attempt at planning, in other words, and coordination of what scarce resources get used where and by whom. It's not clear to me that we should be starving farmers in Mexico to make Jeff Bezos even richer, for example, or that this trade-off is worth enabling a few online retailers to sell personalized t-shirts more effectively. As I hinted at in the first story today, we're living in a world of increasingly scarce essential resources. What happens to water and energy is becoming a growing source of conflict, one that is only set to get worse into the future. These are big decisions, too big to be left simply to those seeking to turn a quick profit. If we are to have any chance of adapting to a warmer world, we must start by reasserting fundamental democratic control over the resources that matter most. If we don't, we risk a future which looks like a slow decay of the present: more sewage in our rivers, less water in our taps, higher and higher bills, and consistently awful AI-powered poetry. On to our third story this week, a brief note on another old favourite, climateflation. This is a concept finally starting to claw its way into the mainstream of economics. Climateflation is the idea that as climate change really begins to bite, shortages from extreme weather disruption, changing farming patterns and so on will start to mount, forcing up prices. In a credit money system, in other words, one where the banks and the financial system can pretty easily create new money, the likely outcome from repeated shortages is that prices get forced up of those essentials and then spill over into more general price rises. On a fairly intuitive basis, this makes sense. We would expect things in short supply to cost more. And we can start to see some of these impacts playing out in the real world. A listener in South Korea recently sent me a news report on rising inflation there, with prices of agricultural products and energy rising 20% over the last year. So something like this seems to be happening kind of everywhere. But a very useful new bit of research in Nature Communications, looking at prices and temperatures in 121 countries over the last 25 years, starts to bring out the real, immediate impacts that temperature changes have already had on prices. The effects, historically, have not been huge because temperature changes have not been so dramatic. But projecting these impacts forward, the research team thinks that if global average temperatures reach the levels currently forecast for 2035, then inflation globally could well be much higher than central banks' 2% target, by half as much again. There's likely to be very substantial variation around this, as different extreme weather events play out, for instance, different kinds of commodities will be affected in different ways. So the current drought in West Africa has sent cocoa prices rising, with cocoa beans today now costing more than gold, gram for gram. But overall, the impact looks like basically higher prices everywhere. What this means, most obviously, is more scope for conflict. We've seen how those higher prices turn quickly into fat profits for a few suppliers, popularly known as greedflation. But really, it's more about the way capitalist businesses will always exploit an opportunity when they see one. In any case, when their profits rise from the soaring price of essentials, it means a real loss for everyone who is still forced to pay extra for their electricity or their food. If there's not a mechanism in place to regulate those shortages and prices, for example, controls and price rises of essentials, that conflict will play out as most of us losing, with a tiny few at the top continuing to gain. Apologies for the doom and gloom there, but I think it's important to follow how these climate impacts are developing in detail. It's only once we understand exactly how these effects are playing out that we can begin to address them, keeping the cost of living down for consumers in the short term, and over the longer haul, developing democratic and resilient institutions to reorganise our economy. So that does it for today's show. Thank you to everyone who has been sending in your listener questions. There are some fantastic topics in there that we'll try to get to on future episodes. As always, keep them coming in, and thank you to everyone who is supporting the show over at patreon.com/macrodose. We really couldn't keep this going without you. Thank you for listening to today's show. Macrodose is a Planet B production. If you enjoyed the show and you'd recommend it to friends, please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes, including our bonus interview content, on our Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose.